G'day, I'm Tom Switzer. Welcome to Between the Lines. Now, today we're taking a trip down political memory lane with Ross Terrell. Now, he's arguably been Australia's leading Chinese watcher for the past half century. Now, I spoke with the Harvard-based Terrell when he was in the country for a few days in March in 2016. We're also going to talk about the media intrusion into the private lives of politicians. Aren't you sick to death of when the media gets stuck into politicians' private life? When did this start in America? My guest, Matt Bai, explores the implosion of Gary Hart's presidential campaign in 1987. Now, that's when journalists got wind of an alleged extramarital affair with a young model and destroyed a potentially great presidency. It was this moment, says Bai, when political journalism collapsed into trivial nonsense from which it's never really emerged. So let's get going. Well, Australia's produced some of the world's leading China watchers. So who's our greatest sinologist? Patrick Fitzgerald or Jeremy Barme at ANU? Is it Stephen Fitzgerald, our first ambassador to the People's Republic? Or Pierre Ryckmans, also known as Simon Lees, or his protege, one Kevin Rudd? Now, for mine, none compares to my next guest. In 1964, Ross Terrell was a 22-year-old young Aussie academic who visited Red China. He was with the Labor opposition leader Gough Whitlam during that historic visit in July 1971. When Nixon went to China several months later, Henry Kissinger recommended that the president read this young Australian's book on Mao's China. Now, these days, Ross Terrell is with the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University. He's back home for a brief visit, and it's great to welcome him back to the ABC. G'day, Ross.
Thank you, Tom, and nice to be here.
In your mid-20s, you quickly established yourself as a leading authority on communist China. What attracted you to the subject at the height of the Cold War half a century ago?
I didn't establish myself. Other people establish you, and you, right. You watch in wonderment. I bounced off India. My teachers at Melbourne University, they were all disciples of Krishna Menon, the Indian defence minister, and Jawaharlal Nehru, and like those two Indian gentlemen, graduates of the London School of Economics. Mm. And so India was our model. India was the democratic way in the third world, and China was the nasty alternative. So I went first to India,
right.
And the moralism of it all dripped and dripped and took away my idealism about India. So I came back to Melbourne and thought, can China be worse? In that sense, I
don't. And that China and India had clashed in the early 1960s.
They clashed while I was in Delhi.
Mm.
And Joe and I came, and he and Nehru shouted at each other. The notion that there was solidarity between these two because they'd both been trodden by imperialists, I mean, it was nonsense.
Yeah.
But Tom, there was another thing that appealed to me as a personality. It was forbidden fruit to go to China.
Right.
And that always interested me. And you wondered why it was forbidden. And some of the coalition people in power made some very silly remarks, you know, that it bothered their conscience that we were still buying wheat from China. Well, may threaten our pocketbook if the price is too high. But I think in trade, this kind of conscience stuff, it had gone too far.
So at the time, that period from 49 to the early 1970s, neither Washington nor Canberra had diplomatic relations with China, but Australia didn't toe the American line on the economic embargo. We still traded with communist China.
We did, and Dean Rusk,
Secretary of State under Johnson and Kennedy,
upgraded a succession of Australian ambassadors, including Keith Waller. And Waller would report this to Menzies, and Menzies would take no notice whatsoever. It was a myth that Menzies just licked the boots of Washington. If he didn't feel like licking the boots, he didn't lick the boots.
Absolutely. Look, Rupert Murdoch set up the Australian newspaper in 1964. He was a man of the left in those days. He was attracted to your work on China. Tell us more.
I went to China, as you mentioned, in 64, and when I came back, I wrote six typescript pages and persuaded the secretary in the Melbourne Political Science Department to type it for me. And I sent it to Rupert in Canberra. Murdoch phoned up and said he wanted to run it. He said, where are the pictures? So I produced all these pictures, and early in 65, he began it on the front page. Every one of them began on the front page.
What was the central message in those essays for Murdoch in the mid-60s?
It was in the last paragraph of the sixth article, which has been quoted in China for years. It says that the Chinese people are in diaspora, they go abroad, they have laundries and they have restaurants, but only when you come to the setting of China and the hills and mountains of China, when you see the overwhelming size of the population, you go from one city with 5 million and then you go to another city of 5 million, 1,000 miles away. Only thus will you see what China is going to mean in future decades. Mm. So it's a paragraph that stood up quite well.
When did you first meet Henry Kissinger?
66, 67. He was a different cup of tea then. And Kissinger became quite friendly to me. But Tom, the atmosphere at Harvard was not yet poisoned by Vietnam. Henry was a Republican, yes. Others like Stanley Hoffman were liberals, but they got on quite well. And Kissinger began to make remarks like, there's better understanding in Tiananmen Square of our Vietnam policy than in Harvard Square. And so that upset everybody.
My guest is Ross Terrell, Australia's leading China watcher. He's based at Harvard University. He's been lionized by Whitlam and Kissinger alike. Ross, why have you become so critical of the communist regime in recent times?
Well, in the 70s, Tom, my concern was with peace and war. I was in the Australian Army with instructors who'd fought in Korea. And Vietnam affected everything for us. I feared this could happen again and we'd be fighting communist China. And I thought the argument for dealing with China was that. It wasn't that the Chinese government treated its citizens fine. It was we didn't want America and China to go to war again.
My point though, Ross, is that since the Whitlam and the Nixon openings in the early 1970s, by any measurement, China's human rights record has improved dramatically. And yet you've become very, arguably more critical of the communist regime these days than you were in the 60s and early 70s. Why?
Yes, that's true. Because Chinese expectations have risen and our access to China has increased. We call it civil society in academic circles. An unofficial China has welcomed us. And if you know some Chinese, you can deal with this unofficial China. And these people have pushed me to be more critical. So we now are dealing with a diverse place with many voices. The case against communist China today is not a moral one. There's a lot of governments worse than China's. The case against it is that the combination of economic freedom and political unfreedom will not work. At a certain point, there's going to be a crisis.
In the past week, we've had Chinese authorities detaining more than 10 people, these supposedly loyal Communist Party members, and they're suspected of involvement in an anonymous letter that calls on the Supreme Leader Xi Jinping to step down from power. Is China's internal power struggle really over?
It's never over. By the way, one reason why we judge China differently compared with 10 or 15 years ago is the end of the Soviet Union. The end of the Soviet Union made us all ponder this question of whether economic freedom and political freedom can be separated indefinitely. And I think that the lesson of the Soviet Union was that it can't. And I think there are China people, Li Keqiang, the prime minister, brilliant man, who understands economics. And he understands that China's magnificent progress in the past 30 years has been made possible by the protection afforded by US leadership in Asia. It's brought peace ever since the Vietnam War ended, and it's brought order to the realm of trade, and China joined the WTO in 2002. Li Keqiang regularly pays tribute to this. Xi Jinping doesn't. It's a big difference.
Mm. Do you think that China is likely to be more aggressive in the region or self-absorbed? After all, it does have a lot of internal problems. You think about the demographic challenges, environmental challenges, and potential economic problems down the road.
Yes, and in addition to those, it has a well-practiced technique of the emperor smiles and he doesn't betray why he's smiling. It's a passive act, and it leads to many possible conclusions, that the emperor thinks you're moving step by step into his web, or that the emperor is afraid and he smiles, which some Asians do. Chinese statecraft. I wrote a whole book on the nature of the Chinese state, the new Chinese empire, because I think they are very good at disguising their intentions, and they're very good at counting the numbers. Now, they're nibbling in Asia. They're nibbling here and they're nibbling there, and they're waiting to see what they can get away with. Now, Japan, under Abe, has been quite resolute, and the nibbling has died down in the East China Sea.
Not in the South China Sea.
Not in the South China Sea. So the Philippines and Vietnam, two most unlikely candidates to stand up to the great China, are doing just that. And Obama, to his credit, is backing them up. The Chinese, for good and for ill, are caught between a past state which assumed their centrality, assumed their benevolence, assumed the weight of their culture all over Asia. They're caught between that and the logic of their economic development, where they have flourished as a nation state.
Ross, thanks for being on the show.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
That was Ross Terrell, the veteran China watcher who's based at Harvard.
On RN Summer, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Many observers of American politics lament the coarsening of the public debate and the journalism that reports on it. The collision of the worlds of public service and tabloid entertainment. But when did the rule for journalists covering politicians, when did that change? My next guest pinpoints the turning point to 1987, the story, the unmasking of a rising Democratic star and presidential candidate as an adulterer. No, not Bill Clinton, but Gary Hart. Now, for more on this intriguing story, let's hear from Matt Bye. He's the national political columnist for Yahoo News and former chief political correspondent for the New York Times. He's the author of All the Truth Is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. Welcome to Australian Public Radio, Matt.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to be here.
Tell us briefly about the Gary Hart story in 1987.
Essentially, Gary Hart was the, whatever you want to say, the Hillary Clinton of his day. He was a presumed nominee of the Democratic Party. He had run in 1984 and come from nowhere to nearly steal the nomination from Walter Mondale, the former vice president. And from the time that campaign ended until 1987, when he announced he would run again, he was assumed to be the Democratic nominee. He was a young politician. He would have been the first of the 60s generation nominated, and he'd been in public life for a long time as a United States senator, but he was also sort of a visionary politician. I mean, a lot of the things that we later associated with Bill Clinton came from Gary Hart. He would have been the first Western nominee. The party still hasn't had a Western nominee. Really saw around the corners of the day in terms of the transformation of the economy and the transformation into a more globalized world. But it all came undone, as you say, in 5 days when a newspaper called the Miami Herald in Florida got a tip that he was having an affair and ended up actually putting him under surveillance and confronting him in the alley behind his house. And in that moment, you know, that really is the first time that a presidential candidate faces sort of a modern sort of celebrity-type sex scandal, and his campaign ended very quickly.
Was the newspaper, just to recap, though, this newspaper published, what was it, a happy snapshot of Hart with this young lady on his lap, and Hart was a married man, but not to the lady on his lap, right?
Yes, although, you know, the photo, which is the only thing everyone in the United States remembers, actually came out after he was long out of the race. So,
right. Is that a fact?
Remembrance about this. The photo didn't actually cause it, but the paper did write about his liaison with this woman. And, you know, Hart had been separated a couple times from his wife. He had dated quite publicly for a long time.
Oh, that's interesting. Jeez.
So he did not think, you know, that his personal life would be fair game. And until that time, the press had really never gone looking, you know, poking around in the private life.
Hadn't Hart taken an overnight cruise on a boat called Monkey Business, which probably just added to the intrigue?
Yes, when the name Monkey Business got out, that definitely fueled the story. And he had, in fact, met this woman, Donna Rice, on a yacht and gone yachting, and the circumstances around it have always been in some dispute. But Hart's position then and now,
yes,
and for 25 to 30 years later, has always been that was nobody's business.
Well, that's right. Prior to 1987, the media never really touched that kind of story. I mean, what were the standards employed by journalists in covering politicians' private lives beforehand?
Well, I think when you talk about the era of modern media, which is where I think you have to focus, you know, where we talk about the media as an impartial, supposedly objective force in American society covering campaigns and the way we think of political media today, you know, occasionally sex and private lives of all kinds did emerge into the news, but generally a couple things were true. One was they emerged into the news because they emerged as political issues.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, take Nelson Rockefeller as an example, or mm-hmm. Ted Kennedy, right? I mean, Nelson Rockefeller was vying for the nomination of the Republican Party. And
New York governor, a Republican presidential candidate who eventually became vice president.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, but Rockefeller's divorce was an issue for Republican voters and therefore a salient media issue. The same, you know, Ted Kennedy, when he drove off a bridge in Chappaquiddick and Cape Cod and a woman died. This was a criminal issue. This was a news event that affected his political fortunes. And so, you know, these things were related to politics. And the second thing is the press didn't go seeking them out. They sort of popped down into the open. Here you have a case where there was no correlation you could really draw to his political life other than to say, boy, you know, if he'd lie to his wife, why wouldn't he lie to everyone else, which is the standard sort of defense of a character issue like this. And it was something the media really went and sought out. I mean, hiding behind his house, hiding in bushes, putting him under surveillance. It started a long and tremendously vociferous debate in the American media about what was fair game and what wasn't. But more than that, I think it presaged a moment where the, you know, the political media became really more predatory and really took the ethos of Watergate, the idea that you needed to vet the candidate to protect the country from people of failing moral character. I think took that to an extreme where we had not envisioned it going.
Matt, why did Hart fail when Bill Clinton succeeded in 1992? Because Clinton, let's not forget, was a womanizing, dope-smoking, draft-dodging governor of a backwater state, yet he knocked off the great George H.W. Bush, who had just presided over victories in the Gulf War and Cold War. How did Hart not get away with it when Bill Clinton did?
You know, that's a fascinating question, Tom, and it comes up often. It's really interesting. And what the reporters who were involved in this would tell you is, okay, we got this out. The public had this incident with Hart, and then it kind of worked through it. And voters decided maybe in Clinton's case it wasn't so important. And so you see, this didn't really change things because the voters just needed to work through it a little bit. I think the answer is actually more disturbing and more profound, which is I think the difference between Hart and Clinton is purely in the way they respond to this kind of scandal. In other words, I know them both, actually, and I've interviewed them both. There's very little difference in intellect. There's very little difference in ideology. In fact, Clintonism, as I say, was largely taken from Hart's platform. They're both absolutely brilliant men and both excellent politicians and electrifying. The real difference is Hart draws a line, as politicians had for many, many decades before, and says, there are things about me you don't need to know, and I'm not dragging my family in front of the cameras, and I'm not asking for your apology, and I'm not going on 60 Minutes to tell you what's happened in my marriage, because this has nothing to do with my ability to serve. Whereas Clinton, as really sort of a new breed of politician, is willing to do or say or endure anything to win and subject his family to anything. He is willing to lie outright to win. But that's not to say that Clinton wasn't a good president or isn't an excellent and brilliant public servant. But what it does, I think, point you to is that what we did was change the criteria of what leadership was, of what a great candidate is. When we talk about Clinton as the most talented candidate of his generation, what we are talking about first and foremost is the ability to evade traps, the ability to beguile, and the ability to get around obstacles. And I would submit to you that for most of the life of American politics, leadership was something very different, and it was something much closer to what Hart displayed in sticking to principle and refusing to yield. And I think there are consequences for that in governance. But I think the point is that we should judge candidates and people in context. This is our job as an industry. We're supposed to provide context. And no one is, as Bob Kerry, the former senator, said to me once, no one is the worst thing they've ever done. And you have to put those things in context. And sometimes in context, it is too hard to ignore what a person has done personally. And sometimes the context makes it even worse. I would point to John Edwards, another former senator, as a case where, you know, understanding what he had done and putting it in the context of his political platform, when he had talked about the responsibilities of fathers in the inner city, but here he is having someone pretend to raise a child that was actually his. That, I think, you can't come back from. I think that was egregious, and an egregious lapse in character. But I think in every case, you have to look at the totality of a person's service and the context of what they've done. And I think, you know, in Hart's case, Rick Hertzberg, writer for The New Yorker, asked this question at the time, I think with great prescience, because no one else did. But where is the evidence of Gary Hart as a liar in politics? Where was the evidence that he lied to voters, that he took money for votes, that he dodged difficult decisions, that he told people what they wanted to hear, that he wasn't a great public servant? No one ever brought any case forward, much less a pattern of behavior. The only thing people found about Gary Hart was that he wasn't a great husband. And in the context of a career of public service, on that basis, can you conclude that someone is too unsound of character to serve? I think if you were to reach that conclusion, Tom, you would, by necessity, have to throw out the greatest presidents in American history and probably the greatest leaders in your country and in Europe and all over. I'm not condoning the behavior. I'm just saying, we can't logically conclude that that is the totality of a person's character and accept history as we understand it.
But has the game changed since, though? I mean, Donald Trump has had a dodgy past, if you like. I mean, he's had three wives. He's presumably had other women on the side. But that doesn't seem to get much media scrutiny.
Well, it gets scrutiny. It doesn't get what we call traction.
Traction is the word I'm looking for.
You know about
it.
Everybody writes about it. Yeah. Whether voters care is another story. But I'll tell you why they don't. And I'll tell you, this is the relevance. I'm glad you brought up Trump. But that may be the longest period I've gone without anybody trying to talk to me about him in the last 6 months. But look, this is the relevance of the Hart story. It's why it's so important. Because what really happens in that moment, in addition to the media becoming sort of a predatory force, is the line between politics and entertainment collapses. And we begin to cover politics as a game and an industry and a soap opera and a drama. And we don't cover it anymore as a contest of ideas or governance. And people love that, and it gets a lot of ratings, and it gets a lot of clicks, and forecasts are all the rage now in the United States. You know, who's going to win, who's going to lose, what are the markets saying, and what are the percentages? We treat politicians like celebrities, and we treat politics like a game played by athletes. And when you do that, you send a signal to voters that you blur the distinction between public business and drama. And you get, ultimately, Donald Trump. And look, there are a lot of steps between Gary Hart and Donald Trump. You know, there was a guy named Jesse Ventura. There was Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. There was Barack Obama, who is himself really marketed as a narrative when he ran for president, more than as someone who was qualified by any experience to run for the office. But ultimately, you get to, I think, inevitably, a Donald Trump, who is an entertainer, who is a television star, who is a public relations maven, who actually knows nothing about governance, who actually has no discernible ideology and no discernible ideas. But he can capture a crowd. He can exploit an emotion. He's obsessed with his own poll numbers. He sees them as indistinguishable. This is a reality show for Donald Trump, and our politics have come to resemble a reality show. And you don't get here without having first gone there, and that's the connection I'm really getting at.
Well, it's a terrific read. All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. It's part history, part memoir, part critique of modern journalism. Matt, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for that description. That is exactly what the book is. I got to write that down, because that's really good.
That was Matt Bai from Yahoo News, who traveled to Australia as a guest of PayPal. And that's all for this week's edition of Between the Lines. Don't forget that if you're looking for something to read,
head to our website at abc.net.au/rn and check out the recommended reading list. I'm Tom Switzer. It's always great to have your company. Let's chat next week.